Quorum being present, I call this meeting of the Board of Directors of the Texas Health Services Authority to order at 10:02. I'm Shannon Calhoun, Chair of the Board, and I would like to welcome board members and guests. As we start our work today, I always think it's helpful that we review our stated purpose as described in the Texas Health Services Authority Enabling Statute, which is Chapter 182 of the Texas Health and Safety Code. The THSA is established to promote, implement, and facilitate the voluntary and secure electronic exchange of health information. The THSA accomplishes this purpose through its HIE, or Health Information Exchange Program, known as HIE Texas, and its Privacy and Security Certification Program, known as Secure Texas. Our first item today is a presentation from our annual audit report by the authorities firm, Maxwell Locke and Ritter. Members, this draft audit report was emailed to you separate from the rest of your board presentation materials, and a printed copy was provided to each of you today. The board now calls A.J. Zimmerhansel of Maxwell Locke and Ritter to the podium.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome. State your name and title and organization for the record, please.
A.J. Zimmerhansel, partner with Maxwell Locke and Ritter.
Members, our next item is the approval of the audit report as laid out before the board.
Not quite yet, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We'll have A.J. do the presentation.
Present before, okay.
Sorry.
So, please.
Thank you. This morning, there's two documents in front of you, and I'll go over both of them. The first one that I want to draw your attention is a stapled letter. It's addressed to the Board of Directors of Texas Health Services Authority. What this letter represents is basically a report card on how the audit went. It's a required communication that we have under generally accepted auditing standards. In the middle, there's a bold section called the Qualitative Aspects of Accounting Practices. In this year, the significant accounting policies to the financial statements are disclosed in Note 2 of the financial statements, and it was a pretty silent year, if you will, as far as new accounting pronouncements that were issued by the GASB, the governing standard board of that resides over the financial statements that are reported here. So overall, everything's very consistent with the prior year, and as far as transactions that were entered into by the organization, everything is covered by those standards, so there's nothing outside the ordinary that we saw in performing our audit. If you turn to page 2 of that letter, I'm proud to say that at the top we had no difficulties encountered in performing the audit. As far as audit adjustments, there were some minor adjustments that occurred in the normal course of the audit, but none of those audit adjustments were a reflection of anything that we were concerned about or that were material in nature to the financial statements. So just part of the normal process that we go through in performing the audit. As far as disagreements with management, we had none. And the last thing I want to point out in this letter is that in an audit, we're making a lot of inquiries of management and requesting a lot of financial support and information. And through that process, George and his group provide us a lot of information. So as a closing item of an audit, we obtain a management representation letter from management, basically for them stating that they are asserting that they responded fully and truthfully to all of our inquiries that we made. So at the back of this letter, in the final version, you see the attached letter that's signed by them. So any comments or questions as it relates to this letter?
If I understand correctly, you are auditing based on government entity practices versus private. We are quasi-governmental, so can you explain how you came to auditing based on government?
Yes, ma'am. So I mentioned that GASB is ultimately the framework of the financial statements that are presented. So you have the Financial Accounting Standards Board, which is FASB, and they cover all for-profit entities and not-for-profit entities. And then for governmental-type entities, GASB covers that, or Government Accounting Standards Board. So you all are in a unique situation because you all are organized as a nonprofit organization, and therefore you have a 990 tax return in the eyes of the Internal Revenue Service. However, in looking at the FASB criteria of how to apply FASB, there's three outs, if you will, that put you over in governmental accounting standards. And one of those is when a majority of the board is appointed by an official of a local, state, or federal government. And in your particular case, you all have a majority that is appointed by the governor. So that triggers you or puts you over into the governmental accounting standards. And as far as the nuances of the standards, FASB and GASB are very similar, but after it's all said and done, the final standards that you abide by are the governmental accounting standards. Yes, ma'am. All right. Next thing I want to do is move over to the financial statements themselves. So that's the bound report that you have. And I'll just hit some highlights here of the financial statements themselves. So if you turn inside the report four pages deep, there's our opinion that's titled Independent Auditor's Report. So I believe it's the fourth page in, or maybe the third page in after the cover page. What the Independent Auditor's Report provides is it's a reminder that the financial statements are the responsibility of management, and as far as our responsibility, we're providing an audit in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards to opine on whether these financial statements are in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. So if you turn to the second page of that, you see our opinion, and I'm proud to say that you all received an unmodified opinion or a clean opinion, or the best opinion. So congratulations to the organization for receiving that. Also included is an other matters paragraph related to required supplemental information that government accounting standards require. And in that process, we reconcile, we read over, we compare everything to the final audited numbers to make sure that that information is consistent with the audited financial statements. And again, we found no issues in that regard. So, clean opinion. If you turn in a little deeper, you'll come to a section called Management's Discussion and Analysis. And specifically, if you turn to page 4, I believe after that all the pages are numbered at the bottom of the report, so I'm on page 4 now. And here I'll go ahead and use Management's Discussion Analysis Financial Highlights as it gives a good overview of the financials themselves. So for the year ended September 30th, 2019, the organization ended the year with approximately $1.5 million in assets. And that those assets primarily consisted of cash of approximately $900,000 and accounts receivable of $570,000. So a strong position at $1.5 million. Accounts payable only amounted to approximately $240,000. So at the end of the year, the organization had unrestricted net assets or net position of approximately $1.2 million. So very strong position overall. In terms of the income statement or the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position, total operating revenues were approximately $763,000. In this current fiscal year, the connectivity services amounted to $760,000, so the organization started earning revenues as it related to that contract. And as a result of that, expenses ended the year at approximately $1.1 million. And pretty significant increase in salaries and contractor services, but that was just a direct result of this contract being in place and meeting the service needs of performing that contract. So after it's all said and done, the organization did have an operating loss of approximately $385,000, and that added to the beginning net position. Ended the year again at approximately $1.2 million in net assets. So very strong year after it's all said and done. Any comments or questions as it relates to the financial statements? After that, so I covered kind of the broad sense of the financials. So that covered pages 8 through through 10 of the financial statements. After that are the notes of the financials, and as I mentioned before, really a year of consistency in terms of financial accounting standards, so there were no significant changes. The notes basically provide some additional information and more detailed information of what I just described. And with that said, I didn't plan on going into anything specific unless there's a question. And at this point, I'll open it up to any questions.
That report.
Yes, ma'am.
Our next item is the approval of the audit report is laid before the board. Is there any discussion? Is there a motion to approve the audit as laid out before the board?
I move to accept the audit report as laid out before the board.
Thank you. Is there a second? Second. Motion has been made and second. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passed. Thank you for your work.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate the continued relationship.
Our next item is the approval of the minutes of November 1st, 2019 board meeting, which are available for review as attachment number 1, PDF page 2, in your documents. I'll give you a second to pull those out if you need to. Is there a discussion? Is there a motion to approve the minutes as laid out before the board?
So moved.
Is there a second?
A second.
A motion has been made and seconded. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Members, our next item is the approval of the minutes of January 30th, 2020 Finance Committee meeting, which are available for review as attachment number 2, PDF page 6, in your attachment documents. Is there any discussion? Is there a motion to approve as laid out before the board?
So moved.
Motion has been made and seconded. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, let me see where I am here. Our next item is the consideration and approval of THSA's financial statements through December 31st, 2019. The financial statements are available in attachment number 4, PDF page 11, in your attachment documents. Mr. Sandstrom Hill, could you brief the members on the financial statements?
Yes, thank you. You'll see on pages 12 to 13 of the attached documents, the THSA continues to maintain enough funds to fulfill its stated purpose. On page 14, you'll see the statement of revenue, expenses, and other changes in net assets. And then on page 15, you'll note that we're under budget in every category. So there's nothing hugely groundbreaking or out of the ordinary there, but we can, George or myself, be happy to answer any questions, if there are any.
Question.
Yes.
For you or George, in looking on page 14 of the Statement of Revenue Expense, there are no revenues, nor have there been for the past few quarters, related to Secure Texas. And there aren't any obvious expenses associated with that program either. And my question is if, A, you have a comment, and, B, if there could be some analysis prepared relative to Secure Texas for presentation at the next board meeting.
I'll defer to George on that one.
Thank you. That's a very good question. No, we do not have revenues associated with Secure Texas during this quarter. The previous quarters have been nominal. We don't have hard expenses associated with them. However, I do assure you that it does utilize a good amount of staff time. Based on the structure of Secure Texas, we don't do all of the work ourselves. Instead, we utilize a multi-vendor approach, which is what stakeholders really wanted from this. And it's a two-tiered process where these vendors our preferred vendors are going out and they're conducting assessments against the standards in our certification, and then they refer those assessments to the THSA for certification. So there is a lot of time spent working with our preferred vendors, providing guidance and advice during the assessment process. We are not, however, seeing those assessments translate into certifications. And I will prepare an analysis for the board by our next board meeting, kind of digging into why we're seeing that break.
And if you would include also then sort of the volume of requests for the service, both the assessment service and the certification service, historically, that would be helpful.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Sexton. Hill. Is there any discussion? Is there a motion to approve the financial statement that's laid out before the board? Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
The motion has been made and seconded. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Our next item is the consideration and approval of the proposed amendments to the THSA's fiscal year 2020 budget. The proposed budget amendment is available as attachment number 3, PDF page 9, in your attachments document. Mr. Gooch, could you brief the members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, yes, if you'll turn to PDF page 9 in your attachments document, and the actual figures are here on PDF page 10. If you'll see in the left-hand column here, we have the already approved 2020 budget, and in the right-hand column, you'll see that we have the proposed amendment. The biggest explanation for this amendment is we're making a change to one line item in here, and that's the amount spent on health information exchange services. And this is highly contingent upon currently there are two contract amendments being processed with our state partners. One is for enhancements to the EDEN project, and the other is for developing the Pulse infrastructure. Those are still under development at this time, and therefore I don't want to go too far into the details of those because our state partners have to do their process for that. However, I just didn't want to be in a position that we're getting the green light to start working on this stuff between now and our next board meeting. And I'm in a situation where we need to spend those funds during this state fiscal year, and we're going over budget as a result. So as we've noted here in the asterisk statement below, yes, we're providing quite an increase in health information exchange services, as the originally approved amount did not include either the enhancements to our current EDEN project or the new Pulse project, but was just maintenance for the Pulse system is what was approved because it's what we had in front of us during the budget approval process. However, I do note that if for any reason these amendments don't get processed, or if we are unable to receive the funds to actually build out this system, we're not going to run rampant and just go spend all this money. it's very much contingent upon receipt of those funds. So in that event, we would revert back to the already approved amount that was in the original budget. We would not spend above that. So any other questions or comments, I'm more than happy to take them.
So even though the funds for that is increasing, you're saying personnel, there's no more personnel that will be allocated, contractual consultants, none of that is going to change? You don't need any more?
So that is a good question, and those are things that we are figuring out right now. I don't have the answers to those questions currently because it is dependent upon what would be in those contract amendments, exactly how we could spend those funds for this health information exchange purpose. but we do know it will be for health information exchange. This is all contingent upon funds that are actually received from CMS that flow through Medicaid. So there are often strings attached to them. So I didn't want to get into the specific level of this would result in contractor expense versus FTE expense versus infrastructure. So they're in health information exchange, and generally those are funds paid to our current health information exchange contractors to develop this infrastructure for us. But that is a very good question. And if that does arise that we get this contract amendment, we need to put those funds in another specific budget category, I would revisit that with you all at the next board meeting. Thank you. Very good question. Thank you.
George, are you expecting, without getting into the specifics, that the two contract amendments, that the funds flowing through those contract amendments would be equal to or in excess of the 3.8 million? In other words, would 3.8 million, and is it in the same fiscal year as when the spend would be?
That's another good question. All of these things are based on our Texas Medicaid Health Information Exchange Implementation Advanced Planning Document, HIE IAPD. And that is a document that is approved by CMS. And they approve those on a biennium basis. But again, sometimes, because they do flow through our state Medicaid program, and it is over the course of a biennium, either it's already like that in the IAPD, or the state Medicaid program needs to budget it in that way where they break it down by state fiscal year. Mm-hmm. Not even adding the complexity of state fiscal year versus federal fiscal year, which around August gets to be very confusing often. We believe that these are the funds that must be spent during this state fiscal year. And the IAPD is approved for funds that cover the biennium, but we would revisit that with our state partners as we move forward. And it would be reflected in next year's budget for the second half of the biennium or the state fiscal year 2021.
Thank you, Mr. Gooch, for that discussion. Is there any other discussion? Is there a motion to approve the budget amendment as laid out before the board?
So moved. Accept budget.
Thank you. I second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Remember, the next item in consideration and approval of the THSA annual report, which is available in attachment number 5, PDF, page 16, in your attachments. Mr. Gooch, could you brief the members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if you will turn to PDF page 16 in your attachments document, you'll find the THSA annual audit report. We are required to develop this under Chapter 182 of the Texas Health and Safety Code to provide an update on the THSA's projects and programs as laid out under statute. And we deliver this report to the governor, lieutenant governor, and the appropriate bodies within the Senate and the House. For us, those would be the House Public Health Committee and the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services. So as you'll see here, this is our report for 2019 calendar year. And we provide an introduction and background on pages 19 and 20. That kind of lay the history of the THSA up to where we are now. On page 21, and I do want to pause for this, we provide an overview of the new board members. I do know that from time to time, some of you may move, some of you may switch jobs, sometimes staff members, never me, could misspell names. So if you do want to look at that just momentarily to make sure that we have reflected the accurate and most up-to-date information, I see Jonathan already making notes, please let us know right now, and that way we can approve the annual report as amended by the board.
Do I need to let you know right now?
Yeah.
Okay. There's just a typo on the name of my company. It's capital with an A, not O.
Capital with an A, not an O, for Jonathan Sandstrom Hills.
I'm going to do it in front of everybody, but...
That's okay. That's okay. Anyone else? No? We got it all correct? All right. With that, we'll keep moving along. On PDF page 23, we have an overview of activities in 2019, and that really breaks down to our partnership with the Health and Human Services Commission, specifically the Medicaid program, to implement the three strategies of the IAPD, and that breaks down into strategy one, connecting Medicaid providers and hospitals to local health information exchanges who onboarded for the project. Strategy two, HIE infrastructure, is connecting those local health information exchanges to HIE Texas, the state level health information network maintained by the authority, or in instances where there is not a local HIE available to connect or connectivity cannot happen for any reason, we do allow for that direct connectivity from these providers and hospitals. And then strategy three is the Emergency Department Encounter Notification Program, or EDEN program. And often you'll hear us just call the project the EDEN program, EDEN project, EDEN system, as shorthand for everything we're doing within the IAPD, because strategies one and two are really the infrastructure that leads to the EDEN system. And that's where we're developing the overarching system, where we're requiring the downstream providers and hospitals and local HIEs to standardize that data that they send up to the state-level HIE Texas, and then it can be outbounded in a statewide standardized format to authorized subscribers, primarily in this case our Medicaid managed care organizations, which we provide an overview of. And then the next item we provide an overview of is the PULSE system, or the Patient Unified Lookup System for emergencies. The big update that we have during the 2019 calendar year is that it was included as part of the IAPD, but some of these things are still being processed as we speak. And then on this next page, 25, we wanted to make sure that we were keeping proper track of previous recommendations and their current status. So there were recommendations made in the 2018 report, and these recommendations are based on the two public hearings that we held in 2018 that we're going to hold again here in 2020. One hearing on the state of privacy and cybersecurity, which aligns with our Secure Texas program, and another hearing on the state of interoperability, which aligns with our HIE Texas program. So we've broken those down by subject matter and the relevant recommendations under those subject matters, and then provided an update. And I'm happy to say that we are moving in a positive direction on all of them. We may not have made significant progress on every single one, but in every single one, we are either making progress or we're still working on it. Nothing has moved backwards, which is always a good sign. We intend to keep doing this in future reports, but really we intend for these to kind of be two-year cycles. We'll do these hearings again here in 2020 for people to provide recommendations, and then we'll provide an update on those recommendations in the following year's report, and then we'll do it again, so forth. And then on page 27, we end with an analysis and conclusion. With that, I am happy to take any questions or comments.
Discussion? Thank you, Mr. Gooch. Does that require the actual vote?
Yeah,
okay, that's what I was making sure. Is there a motion to approve the annual report as laid out before the board? Thank you. A second? Thank you. There's a motion been made and seconded. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed? Motion passes. Members, our next item today is an update from the THSA's CEO, George Gooch, on the Health Information Exchange Services. Mr. Gooch, could you please brief members on this item?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if you'll turn to slide 14 in your board presentation materials, we'll start with a high-level overview of all HIE Texas services in their current form, and then we'll dig a little deeper into each one of these on the subsequent slides. At a high level, you'll see we have four items here. One is the Emergency Department Event Notification System, otherwise known as EDEN. The other is Patient Unified Lookup System for Emergencies, otherwise known as PULSE. And then query-based health information exchange and public health reporting. For EDEN, we've completed the state-level infrastructure build-out, and we're currently building interfaces with our local HIEs, and we'll provide a more detailed analysis of the progress on each of those. PULSE contract under development currently, more to report at our next board meeting. Query-based health information exchange, this has been proposed as an idea for adding this functionality in the future, we'll talk about that a little bit more in depth. And then public health reporting, we've received interest and still working on it. And again, we'll go a little bit more into detail on each of these. With that, if you want to turn to slide 15 in your presentation materials, we'll go with a little bit more in-depth update on the EDEN project. As noted, we have completed building the state-level infrastructure with our subcontractor, Audacious Inquiry. Programmatically speaking, we've had three local health information exchanges who have signed up to be part of the open enrollment under Strategy 1, and those HIEs are HASA, previously known as Healthcare Access San Antonio. Now it's just an acronym that doesn't necessarily stand for anything anymore. Greater Houston Health Connect, Rio Grande Valley HIE are our three HIEs that we are currently working with. We are always actively seeking additional partners. We do want to be working with much more than three partners. Texas is a big state, and it's a lot of ground to cover on your own or even with just a handful of partners. Emily and I have been doing some exploratory steps with that to see, what opportunities there might be in the future there.
Question: what about those health systems that aren't necessarily connected to a local or regional HIE? What's your thoughts in terms of how to get them engaged?
Right. So, for those entities, they will have the opportunity under this project to connect to a local HIE. That is a large part of the reason, and this has been, a real long time coming. From what we hear from hospital systems, but more so on the provider side, is that a real barrier to participation is the upfront cost of developing an interface. And that's why that cost is being covered here at a 90-10 match rate. So we do imagine that there is a good chunk of providers and hospitals who are out there who have been taking somewhat of a wait-and-see approach, who have not participated in the past due to that financial barrier, who will now participate. However, again, with three partners plus the THSA, Texas is still a very large state to cover. So THSA would allow direct connections to HIE Texas for those entities as well. So hopefully we get a lot more market penetration through this opportunity.
So I guess my next question, though, is what do you think the awareness level is by those health systems that are not currently connected to any HIE of A, HIE Texas, and B, the opportunity to connect with this kind of match of the upfront expense or subsidy of the upfront expense?
Right. So we have seen already some marketing emails and newsletter letters kind of floating around. And we've also had offers from members of our collaboration council, which we'll update members on here in a little bit, to be able to utilize their resources and networks to get the word out as well. But marketing is is a big part of this. So that is something that we're relying on all parties who have a vested interest in seeing this project come to fruition to be able to leverage their resources to get the word out on that. But we're still in the very beginning phases of it. I think first we'll go with...
A quick question. What about, I'm thinking about rural and particularly critical access hospitals. The rural health group is a very strong group in the legislative, I know, especially in the lobbying process. And also, I noticed you had Del Rio, but what about the El Paso area? It's another big area.
So I'll field the first part of that, mm-hmm. and I'll let Emily answer the second part of it. Yes, the rural part of the state is very important. We have a very good relationship with Torch, and they were very supportive of the THSA continuing via support of what I can't remember if it's they dropped a card in support either of House Bill 3304 or the companion bill, but either way, they were very supportive of HIE because they do realize that, you know, as HIE and other health information technology continues to develop, it becomes better for the consumer and it becomes, you know, ideally cheaper to utilize. And that is something for an area of the state where resources are important. And, you know, HIE might be item number 30 on the list when they're trying to keep the doors open is always a challenge. So, you know, they believe in health information exchange as a possible avenue to be able to help them lighten that load, but it has to be under the right conditions. And hopefully this project and being able to cover those costs at a 90-10 rate for the upfront interface would be something that can really help that part of the state. As for the wonderful El Paso region, I'll defer to Emily Hartman.
George. So yes, the El Paso Health Information Exchange or FIX plans to connect with THSA. We're reviewing legal now. We chose not to pursue the contract through the open enrollment with HHSC, but we do plan to participate fully in interoperability with THSA.
And that is something, just to add on to that is, just generally speaking, it is an open enrollment. So it is something that not just for FIX if they were to ever reconsider that approach, but other health information exchange entities that are out there, it could come back open. I don't have any specifics on that, but just generally, it can reopen.
Just to add to that, we've also, in our region, are offering very reduced rates for hospitals, as low as my legal counsel will let me go without violating safe harbor. So we're hoping to broaden connection with folks too. We're charging $50 to connect, so most physicians can spare.
At a 90-10 rate, you get 45 of that covered.
Questions? Okay.
Yeah, just speaking of marketing messages to kind of notify health systems and providers about this, I received an email recently from the Harris County Medical Society that seemed to suggest that the Greater Houston HIE had received some sort of Medicaid grant to facilitate provider connectivity. Is that related to what we're talking about here, and how does that impact our Eden project?
Yes, so I have also seen that email. So it does not mention THSA or Eden, but I assure you it is the Eden project. That is because Greater Houston Health Connect is one of the entities that enrolled via the open enrollment process. The only thing I noticed on there was that, and maybe it doesn't make a difference to the end user audience of this, is it calls it a grant. And this is, as far as we're aware, not grant funding. This is a contractual relationship. So that's the only kind of caveat I would make to it. So yes, it is the Eden project. It is meant to be done in partnership with the THSA through the THAE Texas. The only other part is it's not a grant. But again, like people are getting things paid for. I don't think they really care if you call it a contract, a grant, or an elephant. They're happy to receive funding to participate.
And then Victoria had a question.
Yes.
My question is that Do we have a goal, or is there a number that you'd be satisfied with in terms of participants?
So, yeah, so that is a very good question. That is something that is currently under development between THSA and the participating local health information exchanges. Because figuring out how to partner on the business side of this is not an easy task, because there are already people who are at the local level who are partnering with MCOs in certain pockets of the state. And what we're looking to do is to pivot towards a partnership for statewide. And we've had those difficult conversations. Hello, Phil Beckett. And they're going in a very positive direction, how we figure that out. But what we all know is we are very far away from 100% participation of Medicaid providers, Medicaid hospitals, and Medicaid MCOs. And we do know that given the small number of entities who are operating health information exchange-wise here, if we get to that 100%, that's an easy win for everyone. What we've been doing or in the middle of doing is trying to collect data on Texas Medicaid market coverage by our local HIEs. We've obtained that information from two of our local HIEs, still waiting on it from a third, so we can figure out what is our coverage currently and what's the difference between that and, you know, the 100% coverage, and where along that line does it really start to be more sustainable. So that is something we're very actively trying to figure out right now and develop those goals once we've reached the end of that analysis. And I hope to have that to you by the next meeting. There's one more question floating around out here. Yes, Eric.
Question about connectivity options for those facilities not going through, say, local HIE. Of course, we talked about the marketing and awareness aspects. One other point I wanted to make is that the technology we procured also is specifically designed to be very flexible. And so, for example, a regional HIE or a small FQDN without a sophisticated IT department still could, for example, connect to the THSA in the event that they cannot go through the preferred approach of connecting through local HIEs as well, too. So that barrier was intentionally lowered.
And we do maintain the list of participating local HIEs on the THSA website so that when people do come to us, they know that here are the list of participating health information exchanges, and these are our options to go to for us to connect locally. It's the benefit of the networks of networks approach, is we maintain less interfaces at the state level, the more partners that we have on the ground level. So. With that being said, our next step after we we'll provide an update on these three legal agreements, the state level trust agreement, the Eden participation agreement, and the business associate agreement on our next slide. But our next steps after we build these interfaces with local HIEs, work out these legal agreements, is to engage payers. And the next phase that we're looking at is developing a type of query-based functionality to layer on top of our push-based functionality for this project. With that, if members want to go to slide 16, we have a chart here that talks about status of each of our legal agreements for participation in statewide HIE. And you see on the far left column, we have our three local HIEs who are participating in the Eden Project. And then across the top, we have each of our legal agreements. BAA is Business Associate Agreement. BAA Amend is an amendment to the Business Associate Agreement. SLTA is State Level Trust Agreement. And then PA is Participation Agreement. So I'll do a brief overview of what each of these agreements are, but I believe Kenneth has.
Yeah, I had a quick question just on the previous slide on the payer front.
Yeah.
So has there been any thoughts about engaging HHSC, or is it even an opportunity to try to use some of those 90-10 match funds to potentially pass through rates to the MCOs to help pay for this?
So that's a good question. I would ponder that may not be an option at this time, just because these 90-10 funds are for infrastructure development. For ongoing maintenance and operations, which I believe is what would fall into that category, if I'm understanding correctly, that would not be available for high-tech funds. However, part of what our Medicaid program generally, not just for our project, is looking to do is to pivot to a different pool of funds called MMIS funds in 2021 that potentially could be a 75-25 match rate. And this is a large part of why the THSA was extended in statute. We were originally slated to become a private entity in 2021. And the whole backstory to that is we went through the sunset review process in 2015, in which sunset recommended that THSA, among a number of other smaller quasi-governmental entities, move into the private sector. The legislature said, that's a great idea, but there's still all this federal funding on the table, and THSA is a core component of our state HIE plan. Those funds go away in 2021, so we're keeping THSA around until 2021. And then in this past legislative session, they heard about a number of other states that are looking to pivot from these high-tech funds to MMIS funds. And that's when they said, oh, well, if there's going to be more funding available, then let's keep this entity in play. Let's not just send them into the private sector just yet. So, you know, that is something, to answer your question, I believe may be appropriate for a future discussion, but I do not think would be available today. Any other questions before I just apparently blow right past board members skipping through these slides?
I have a question on the slide that you were on the contract
slide,
status.
Slide yeah. 16.
Yeah.
Okay.
So everybody sort of probably came on board. You announced at the same time. What is the hurdles or barriers for having one that's not as far along? Or is it just they took an order, or is there a complication?
Right. So for all of these agreements, we had a we had a kickoff meeting on January 13th with our local health information exchanges and the Health and Human Services Commission. And we provided an overview of the project, and we discussed each of the legal agreements that would be involved. And this is just the agreements that are between the THSA and the local health information exchanges. Like, there are several others that we're not a party to, you know, directly between local HIEs and HHSE. Directly between THSA and HHSC, sub-vendors, et cetera, that is a much more complicated chart. This wasn't even the first time that these agreements have been in front of our local HIE partners. We had a state-level query-based platform that we utilized from 2013 through 2017, and these are the same agreements that were in play then. We have modified them to an extent to address the current project that we are working on. So there was some discussion with local HIEs in advance of January 13th to say, hey, you know, just maybe dust these off, take a look at them, because these are what will be in play, which is why we have all greens for the business associate agreement. For the majority of our local HIEs, all the way back in 2013, they signed a business associate agreement with us. For anyone unfamiliar with what a business associate agreement is, under HIPAA, we have covered entities, which are, you know, healthcare providers, health plans, healthcare clearinghouses. They're responsible for maintaining this data on behalf of their patients. And then we have business associates. Those are the contractors that those covered entities hire to maintain protected health information on behalf of covered entities. One step down from that is what's called a subcontractor business associate. So in this scenario, Medicaid providers and hospitals are the covered entities. Local health information exchanges are business associates. HIE Texas is actually the subcontractor business associate. If you have a business associate, if you're a covered entity who has a business associate, or if you're a business associate who has a subcontractor business associate, you're required under HIPAA to have a business associate agreement to lay out the rules of the road for how you will safeguard this protected health information. it is a first step you should take all the time, no matter what, which is why far in advance of THSA even going live with any platform ever, we develop business associate agreements that we entered into with our local HIEs. Those are still in play today. So all we really had to do is dust those off, take a look at them, which is why in this second column here, we have a BAA amendment. The only thing we need to do is both the THSA and local HIEs have moved once or twice in our case since we originally entered into these agreements, and the notice section for these agreements, we needed to update the addresses for those. So that was also a fairly simple one. The third column here is state-level trust agreement, and this lays out the rules of the road for exchanging health information statewide. We base it very heavily on an entity that is somewhat similar to us at the national level called the eHealth Exchange. And the entire point of developing a trust agreement is you have one shared agreement that everyone signs on to. This dramatically reduces the negotiation involved and the exponential number of point-to-point agreements for entities who are sharing information with each other across this network. Everyone just says, hey, this is the agreement. These are the rules of the road that we're going to play by to exchange health information, reasons for transacting message content, what you can do, what you cannot do, et cetera, et cetera. So THSA modeled the HIE Texas state-level trust agreement very heavily after the eHealth Exchange's DRSA data use reciprocal support agreement. I think I got all those words right. We've made varying progress on that. That is an agreement we had in play previously under a prior platform. We revived it. We made a red line version of it to show we're still staying in line with the DRSA, but since we last had our state level trust agreement, there have been several amendments to the DRSA. Thank God the eHealth Exchange keeps track changes versions of their documents on their website. It made it a lot easier for me to be able to not only make those changes, but show the local HIEs, here are the changes we made, and it aligns perfectly with these changes to the DRSA. And then the participation agreement, that's the toughest one. That's where we're figuring out the business terms on this, and this relates to our discussion earlier about we do have local HIEs in different pockets of the state who are currently partnering with MCOs. This is a project that has been in development for a number of years. Not surprisingly, our MCOs did not sit on their hands, neither did our local HIEs. They went out and they developed a lot of that business directly while we were trying to get this figured out at the state level. So how do we pivot now from what's happening in various pockets of the state to partnering together on a statewide standardized basis? And again, the easy answer is we're doing something to get 100% participation of Medicaid across the board. But we're not there today, obviously. So until we get there, you know, these agreements on how we come to business terms of things is not easy to figure out, which is why I put it all the way on this side, just hoping you guys would get tired of reading this chart by the time you went from left to right. But so we have three entities here, HASA, RGV, and Greater Houston Health Connect. They've all signed the business associate agreement for years. We have two out of three that have signed the amendment to the business associate agreement. And then congratulations to HASA being our first signatory again to the state level trust agreement. I think without probably knowing it, this really put them in the driver's seat because once they were the first entity to sign that agreement, it's a trust agreement. There's no longer negotiation of that agreement. The only way that agreement is changed is through the formal amendment process in section 23.02 of that agreement and attachment number 4. Phil Beckett here, he gets to sign off on any amendments that are proposed to this agreement. One of the advantages of being first in time. Congratulations, Phil. RGV, they still have that under review by their outside counsel. And then for the participation agreement, we've gone through a couple iterations of this. We had a very positive meeting where we made a lot of progress with HASA and RGV just the other day, but we're still working on it. To finally get to your question, Madam Chair, across the bottom here, we do have a lot of red. We have our third HIE who has not been responsive to emails about this subject matter, which is disappointing, but we hope to make progress there. We do have another entity that's knocking on the door that covers that part of the state who really wants to participate. They did not enroll through the open enrollment process, but if there is a way to partner and we have a big chunk of the state missing, we have a responsibility for statewide HIE, and we will explore that opportunity. So just know that we are working on backup plans if things don't come to fruition with all parties involved.
One point of clarity. Is it expected that if we have individuals directly contracting that they would go through this whole process with this level of contracting, like small entities, or is this a unique situation because they're HIEs?
So mostly, yes. So if we were to direct connect someone, they're a hospital, they're a covered entity under HIPAA, we would be a business associate to them. Not a subcontractor business associate two levels down, we would be a business associate one level down. So there needs to be a business associate agreement that is in their best interest to do that. The state level trust agreement, we would have them sign on to that because they would be sending and or receiving, you know, message content via the HIE Texas network. The participation agreement is the thing that would probably look a little bit different. That would just lay out the terms of what they're getting, right, you know, in right. terms of what they're paying for, as opposed to what a partnership looks like. So most of the same agreements, only one of them looks a little bit different.
But it wouldn't be a barrier for them. I think that's my point, is that this process isn't necessarily a barrier unless there's someone having to shift from their platform.
Right. I most certainly hope not. Okay. But this is, you know, something we've had in place for a while, and this or something similar to this are pretty standard agreements for most types of health information exchange that happen. The, like, for instance, eHealth Exchange, the national level HIE, they have all these agreements very similar. I know our local health information exchanges have business associate agreements and participation agreements. Probably not a state level trust agreement, but that could be within a lot of similar terms within your participation agreements. So hopefully it's not something that becomes a barrier. If it does, we will keep you all advised about, you know, any modifications we need to make to that process.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments before we move on to our update on Pulse? Okay. Members, if you'll turn to slide 17, deeper dive on Pulse. Contract amendment is underway. The Pulse was included in this version of the IAPD. However, that is still under process at the state level. So we're waiting on that, and then we can get started on being able to build out the system. The big challenge that we have, because not everything is under our control. Actually, very little is often under our control, being the quasi-governmental entity that's kind of in the middle of all of this. Our goal is to be able to build out a minimum viable product for this hurricane season. Hurricane season starts on June 1. So, you know, the further we get along, the more challenging that may be. But it doesn't, you know, really heat up until mid-August. Not to say that you know, a large hurricane can't come and hit anytime before then, or that we can't have another type of natural disaster or declared emergency, such as one of the things we're discussing is application of the Pulse system to coronavirus quarantine environments. Knock on wood, hopefully we're not going that far down the path there, but this would be very applicable to that type of scenario. If we find ourselves in a situation where entities are seeking care or are quarantined outside of a traditional hospital setting, or they are moved outside of their current region of care to another region of the state. But the whole point is things like that can happen at any time. Our goal is to have something built for this hurricane season, but again, you know, that's only so many things that we can do. It got approved in the IAPD. When it got approved, the state goes through their process. Just know that we're doing everything that we can to shorten our runway to be able to get something built. Next steps would be procure a vendor, build the platform, engage stakeholders. Any questions or any more specific detail anyone would be seeking on Pulse at this time?
How soon do you think a vendor will be locked down for that?
So one of the questions we're finding out is whether this is an activity that we can do in parallel, is put the word out for a subcontractor to help for that. I'm sure if you were to ask the vendor community, the answer is like next week. We're hoping to, from when we start that procurement process to when we end it, I'm hoping for that to be a one-month process. Actually building and developing the system, our goal would be, again, preferably by June, may not be a possibility, definitely by August. And we will be noting that in our procurement document, that this is the goal. If you don't feel that you're up to the task, please don't, even bother applying. that's just one of the challenges that we have. With that, unless there are any other questions or comments on Pulse, we can move along to slide number 18. And that is an update on query services. We've been getting a lot of general interest in the THSA's old model, which is we had a statewide query-based health information exchange system. And as part of that, we connected into both local health information exchanges and to national health information networks and frameworks, such as the eHealth Exchange network and the Care Quality framework, which allowed us to connect directly to other care quality implementers, which is what we were easier. This provides for a cheap and quick point-to-point connectivity. So it was a lot of the entities that we were receiving interest in this from were entities who were in parts of the state that were currently not engaging with a local health information exchange, really still wanted to connect to them via us and wanted to do it easily. They're like, yeah, just stand back up your query-based services, turn all that on, become a care quality implementer, and we can just exchange with them that way. All those things do cost money. And at the time we were doing it, it was a gap in time where we were really operating just in the private sector. So most of the things that we do as a public-private partnership were designed for participation across the public and private sectors. For example, the Eden Project, it includes both, Medicaid providers and hospitals and local HIEs, but then on the other side of that, we have Medicaid itself and these Medicaid managed care organizations. And we're designed perfectly to be the statewide entity for that. It includes a lot of public and private participation, and it is ultimately what makes that a sustainable venture. The challenge that we have with the query-based services is not only was that something that was challenging to do on such a broad scope or broad range, being a state the size of Texas, a lot of query-based health information exchange services operate sustainably, hopefully, within a referral pattern, which is why a lot of our health information exchanges, if you were to lay down a map of referral patterns over them, you would see a pretty good amount of alignment, because 90 to 95% of health information exchange happens, locally. When you have a sore throat, you don't find the best ENT statewide, you find the best one you can drive to. And those are the entities that want to exchange information with each other. On a statewide basis, doing just query-based health information exchange by itself, we were solving an edge use case. It was about 5 to 10% of the exchange. So it is, however, something that we're looking to add on to our EDEN system for the time being, because currently EDEN is a push-based system. ADT feeds that are pushed from provider to local HIE to HIE Texas and outbound, but it would be beneficial to add on a query-based service or an auto-query-based service to be able to exchange CCDs or continuity of care documents as well. And traditionally, the way those types of documents are exchanged is not via push functionality, but via query-based functionality. So the idea would be that we are creating an auto-query functionality, either with our local HIEs or the end providers, to be able to exchange that type of data as well, and then push it out to authorized subscribers. So we're looking to add that functionality on, very much still in the planning phase, but that is how we are slowly but surely bringing query-based functionality, that and with Pulse, which is also a portal-based query system, back into the fold. But it wouldn't be just your general, everyday query-based health information exchange, which is a lot of what happens within our local health information exchanges. So that's kind of where we're at right now with query-based services. Again, still very much in the planning phase. And a lot more, hopefully, towards the end of this fiscal year, and a lot more after that in the next. Any questions or comments on the query-based functionality? No? With that, we can go to public health reporting. This is something that's always been on the roadmap for HIE Texas, and it was part of our original state HIE plan, that this was to happen, you know, for we'd leverage the network of networks model that we were building out here in the state. And this would be highly beneficial to providers and hospitals who are required to report health information to the Department of State Health Services. And the three big registries that we always kind of keyed in on for this was the Cancer Registry, Communicable Disease Registry, ELR, or MTRAC. Because currently, this is required reporting, well, not currently, it always will be, that providers and hospitals have to report to the Department of State Health Services via their public health gateway. But then if they also want to participate in health information exchange, that is two interfaces that they're building. So if the state were to be able to leverage the network of networks model, instead of building two interfaces, they could build one, and they could report that information via the health information exchange. That is something that is very much still on the roadmap. We've been in discussions with DSHS about it, about can we utilize the EDEN infrastructure to do that. And I think right now it's really figuring out who pays for this, because I don't think it's something that DSHS currently has budgeted. THSA doesn't currently have budgeted. But it is something that we are very much actively engaged in. We've had one conversation with HASA, who has had a who's also been trying to figure out how they would do this in partnership with an organization called Oz Systems. So that's kind of where we're at right now. I won't even call that planning phase. That's pre-planning phase, but it's on the radar.
Conversations with Dishes, have they talked about a timeline that they're looking at there? Because I have heard that they are looking to upgrade their transaction for immunizations soon.
No timeline. I wish I had more to add to that. But it's basically, when it's not something that's identified as part of the upcoming budgets, like they can plan on two-year cycles for new and additional functionality with this type of stuff. And I don't know currently where they're at with this, but we are here to be able to leverage this Eden infrastructure if that is something that they are interested in. And I know that everyone's interested in doing it. It's just, you know, how do we all work together to make that come to fruition?
Hey, George. In the same vein, any conversation around the prescription drug monitoring program?
So prescription drug monitoring program, I would say as far as the state level, there is not. That is something that we did previously have a grant for and a contract for to be able to develop that did not come to fruition. And then even if it did come to fruition, it probably would have needed some upgrades because it was right around the time that the PDMP was transitioning from the Department of State, from the Department of Public Safety to the Pharmacy Board, and likewise transitioning from the vendor that DPS used to APRIS. So in the meantime, there's been a lot of developments by APRIS and our Pharmacy Board, where they are really directly connecting to EHR systems, and there's funding available for it. So I would say at this point, you know, it sounds like all of that is moving forward, and we don't have the answer right now for what the value we would add in the middle of that. It's a challenge because, you know, PDMP is not something that was included in the original, you know, meaningful use program or the State HIE Cooperative Agreement program. They're two different systems or similar types of systems that grew up far apart from each other. And now everyone's figuring, how do we bring them back together now that we have somewhat of an opioid crisis to deal with? Because that's important data to be able to exchange under the correct circumstances. But as far as the role that HIE Texas would play at this time, I don't know that there currently is one.
I would just make the case there is some collaboration, but it's primarily with retail. And unfortunately, it's the hospital physicians that get caught in the ER that don't necessarily have that information. Because the majority of prescriptions are filled through retail, the responsibility is heavily on retail pharmacies. And right now, it's a two-step. I can just tell you, for my hospital, it's a two-step system for our physicians. We're Cerner Hospital, and so they have to go out of Cerner and into the PMP program prior to writing discharge prescriptions. But more from the standard of care, I think that's important because in the moment of opioid crisis, you don't have the full picture that you could have, because that information, if they've obtained the drugs legally through the system, would be there for the physician or attending.
And first and foremost, very good comment, very well appreciated. And it kind of reminded me that today is February 28th. We got a big date coming up. March 1st is when PMP reporting becomes mandatory. So it's definitely on everyone's mind, and it's a very important issue. Another thing I would say that we're looking at that could be valuable that we've discussed, I sit on the National Pulse Advisory Committee, is being able to access that information in time of disaster, because that would be very relevant information, and being able to access that info would be greatly beneficial. So that is something also we're keeping an eye on for the Pulse project. Unless anyone else has any other questions or comments, we actually will keep going. If you'll look on slide 21, slides 21, 22, and 23, we've embedded our project plans for development of interfaces with each of our local health information exchanges. As you can see here, we are in varying stages of development with each of them. We've had the initial kickoff call with each one of them. The one that we're making the most progress with currently is HASA. And Then RGV, they are in the middle of migrating their data center, I believe. So apologies, Andrew, if I got that detail wrong. But so we're looking at a little bit of a delay there. But HASA is doing well. And then we had our kickoff call for development of the interface with Greater Houston Health Connect just this week. So these are all, as of the date that we sent you these meeting materials, which is Thursday last week. So there have been some minor updates to each of them. Eric, anything major that developed over the last week that's specifically worth noting? I'm asking you that, and I'm not even really sure.
Yeah, the real progress is we're actually fully engaged with HASA, and we're, I think, right on the cusp of getting connectivity actually flowing. We saw a few bits go back and forth this week, so we're just finishing up the actual final connectivity. So it's really, really, really rewarding to see some data starting to actually flow. So I think we're right on the cusp of connectivity there.
Any questions or comments on development of the interfaces with any of our local HIEs? That brings us to the end of our HIE update.
Any further discussions on the HIE update? All right. Our next item today is an update from the THSA's CEO, George Gooch, on the THSA Collaboration Council. Mr. Gooch, could you please brief the members on this item?
Thank you, members. If you'll turn to slide 27, and in your attachments document, if you'll see attachment number 6, PDF page 28, you'll see the materials from our kind of kickoff of our new collaboration council. That is a function that we have utilized in the past. We had moved it to meeting on an ad hoc basis, which was very infrequent over the last few years. And by the time we sat down and realized we needed to kind of restart this collaboration council, a lot of the original members of it were no longer in that role or no longer in Texas or no longer participating in this type of function. So we put the call out for new members. And if you'll see in your attachments document on page 31 and 32, we do list out who all the members are of that collaboration council. So the real purpose of this collaboration council goes hand in hand with the structure of the Texas Health Services Authority as a public-private partnership. Again, if we were to operate just on the government side of the equation, they would have made us a full-blown state agency with regulatory authority. If we were operating just on the private side of the equation, then, you know, we would be no different than one of our local health information exchanges. We're really this entity that sits somewhere in the middle. Our public-private partnership is derived from our partnership with state health agencies, with local health information exchanges, with providers, hospitals, et cetera. And this board is appointed by the governor. So likewise, we have our own collaboration council, so we can hear from the private side of the equation, and that will advise staff, that will advise this board. So we're hearing through and through what is happening for health information exchange in both the public and private sectors, hopefully in all parts of the state. As you can see here, we have representation from the Hospital Association, Health and Human Services Commission, eHealth Alliance, local government, local HIE, from our payer community, from the vendor community, from Baylor Scott & White, Gallagher, Pharmacy Association, Medical Association, Torch, and TMF Health Quality Institute. So the real kind of twofold benefit of this is we don't just want to hear what their input is on the projects that we're participating in. Hopefully it's a good headway into us collaborating with them on what they're working on. How do we find common resources? How do we find mutual goals? For instance, the Medical Association, we have Ms. Vogel here in the audience, invited the THSA to participate in their health IT committee meeting. And again, it's really good to know kind of from physicians, like what are their opinions about what's going on with health IT, HIE, and hopefully we can be able to do the same with some of these other entities that are on here, the Hospital Association, eHealth Alliance, vendor community, et cetera. So this really helps us form better partnerships and goes hand in hand with our structure as a private, public-private entity. So we provided the agenda, the slides. The first meeting went very well. We provided an overview of what our current project is, which is the Eden Project. We had them provide input on what would be appropriate for data elements and identifiers for data exchanged through the project. And we will be expanding that as we add additional functionalities, additional projects and programs moving forward to be able to advise staff and to be able to advise this board moving on.
Question. At least since I've been on the board, we've done a lot of discussion about interaction between entities. I'm thinking on the patient side of things, assistance for, particularly I'm thinking of the Medicaid population, Medicare population, Medicaid being very transient in providers and Medicare having multiple providers. I think research has shown, I think in Florida you can have as many as 10 providers for one Medicare patient. Where are we in the state and in this collaboration process towards being able to provide health information in a chip, in a card, or somewhere that is that does move with the patient so that the next provider or the continuum provider is able to have adequate information to begin the process of care for the patient? Because you're basically the provider starts from step one again when you're going from one to the other.
Right. So that's a very simple question with a very complex answer. So really that goes hand in hand with everything that we've been updating here from the state level that we can do is through the Eden Project. And that is to create the incentives for these Medicaid providers and hospitals to be able to participate in the Eden Project. And the goal really is to cut down on any burden on patients to have to transport data on their own. We want everyone involved in the continuum of care to be able to have ready access to that information under the appropriate circumstances.
A lot of times when providers retire, et cetera, some of them, they retire and patients know afterwards, and so they don't even have access to records to go with them. And, I think it's important that we do this for providers, but I think our ultimate responsibility is to our Texas citizens.
Yeah, and as you mentioned that, I'm remembering it's been the better part of a decade now, but as part of passage of House Bill 300 in 2011, there was required an analysis about what happens when a covered entity no longer continues to function and what happens with that data. And I can't remember anything more than that. That might be something that we can dig up. And
big safety issue. I can just, speaking as a pharmacist, I had oversight for a short period of time of a long-term care, and just seeing the errors that occurred from coming from an acute care when we did our reconciliation, just in medicines, the number of errors that we caught was very scary. And just not having the adequate information is just, I just think we've got to maintain the safety of our patients first.
And the only other thing I'll add is outside of the THSA, there is a lot of development. We have local health information exchanges that are boots on the ground trying to connect these providers. We have other national networks such as, Commonwell, Care Equality, eHealth Exchange. We have the vendor community who is engaging in this. It's a constantly evolving area.
But there's one place where there's one voice.
Right. So our goal is to, how do we unify that? How do we reach those common goals within the state of Texas? And how do we move forward and dovetail off of each other's successes? So hopefully a lot more positive things of that nature to report as the Collaboration Council moves forward.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, over the, I don't know how many years we've been talking about sharing data and that onset of meaningful use even before that, I think that what is critical, especially in the rural marketplaces and small and individual physicians, is the ability to document in discrete data so that it can be shared appropriately. If that doesn't happen, then we're all sunk. Because if it's on a stack of paper with the chronically ill, the stack is this big and the chip isn't big enough. I mean, it would be complex if it's not discrete. So that's part of what was really a great outcome of practice transformation. And then the next step, it really is led to what we either have great opportunity from or we have barriers, and that is the interoperability component. So having the ability to have discrete data that speaks across systems is a barrier more than it is a patient carrying it, I believe. I worked in transformation for 5 years, and that's really what I saw, was that physicians want to speak, patients want to know, but if we don't get it into terms that can be consistently across the sharing community, then we haven't succeeded in making it safer for the patient. So I think we're on the path here. This is important here in that aspect.
And I think your point is so spot on.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's so spot on. I'll tell you, just to take it one level up from where Shannon just left it, I mean, the other real issue that's in play is, okay, we can have these discrete data. Most people have EHRs in place now that are capable of outbounding these data, mostly. And we've got providers now documenting in something other than blocks of text, so that's really good. And we're connecting providers to these networks that allow us to exchange them. But the next step up from that is, how consumable are these data by the physicians in the practice, in the field, by the EDs when they've got, you know, crazy sets of things? How reasonable is it for them to get this, consume it, and once they consume it, they have to reconcile it with what they already know. Mm-hmm. It is so time-consuming. And it's a real, you know, we're leading the horse to water, but we still haven't started drinking it yet because it's we've got all the building blocks in place, but it's still really difficult in practice to make this usable, other than certainly in a disaster circumstance, then, you know, everyone's desperate for the data. But I'm talking about just in everyday practice, boy, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
It's all of our collective responsibilities to encourage it, but it is still a big road ahead.
Well, the
crisis
we have
in
mental
health.
I mean, you can't just check
the box.
No.
So if I could kind of underscore some of the approaches where TSA is taking to address some of these issues, if that's all right. These are certainly real problems. For example, the issue of systems being able to consume or generate content is not enough. They have to be interoperable. Which I define as basically meaning that the receiver can get that medical data and understand it in a way intended by the sender of that data. So what the THSA has done to address this concretely is we've actually put in place technical standards. And our technical standards align with national and international standards as far as data exchange. And even that's not good enough today. So what we've been doing is participating in eHealth Exchange, providing guidance and advice, and I think potentially soon connectivity, possibly, back into the exchange again. And one of the things that they've done is they've also recognized, the eHealth Exchange has recognized that content quality is insufficient nationally and worldwide. And so about 6 months ago, the eHealth Exchange put into place a contractually required obligation that 100% of participants must submit content for interoperability assessment in terms of both quality and conformance, which are different topics. Quality, for example, could be completeness, whereas conformance just means that the data is in the right fields in the right place. And within, I believe it's 12 months from now, they have to pass that test. And basically, their experience has been so far that almost, I believe, 100% of organizations that went through that higher bar of content quality testing failed. I believe every EMR in the United States failed to pass that test. And the tests were based on HL7 standards. And to show you, to underscore how important this is and how critical this is to our state, the specifications created by the Health Exchange to assess content quality, at great expense to them, were turned into an actual technical implementation program. So there's technology that actually automates this assessment process. And to show that basically the exchange was the first really worldwide to do this, they actually found bugs and defects in the HL7 content specifications themselves that no one else had found or brought to their attention. And the root cause of that, when drilling down, was found that HL7 is pointed to by federal regulations. And federal regulations actually point to a fixed version of an artifact produced by a standards body. So HL7 feared they could not change the standard. So that issue has been addressed and overcome. HL7 has actually fixed the issues the Yield Exchange brought to their attention. Those are now in production. And so my expectation is the specifications in that process would be also adhered to within Texas, allowing the content to be measurably, improvably of high quality and fully interoperable at the discrete data level.
Great conversation. Great point.
I was curious if those EMRs have made those changes. Is that what you were just saying?
The EMRs are in the process of making those changes now. I believe a few of them are starting to trickle through in passing. I think 18 have passed or something along those lines. And the great thing is there's teeth to this. They will essentially, at this point, be removed from the Yield Exchange in approximately 12 months by the Yield Exchange community itself unless they pass this bar, which will just help us as well, too.
Question? Thank you for that. And thanks for all of your questions. Well directed and appropriate for today. With no other discussion moving forward, I'd like to move to the future meeting schedule and make point that the third date, we do have a change from May 15th to May 1st, and thank you for that. The August 21st is correct, but Friday, November 1st is not. It should be November 13th. It actually is for your invitations and your calendars. It is correct, but it's just a typo on this slide deck. So we do have it correct as the 13th, but that's a correction on the document. Yeah.
To be fair, you only notified me at the last board meeting that was incorrect. You can't expect me to get this right just by the very next meeting. Okay. We will have it correct on the slides by the next board meeting.
May is May 1st, yes. That was the last doodle poll that we went through and changed it. So November 13th is the change that's in this slide deck. So do you have any questions or comments about the schedule? Any other comments? Do the members have any items they would like to be included on the next meeting agenda? Is there anything on the next agenda? All right, with that, before we move into executive session, I would like to ask if there's anyone that would like to provide public comment at this time. Have we had anyone sign in? Yeah. Does she need to sign in? Do we need to?
Do you have a...
Not fill out a form. I will get it for you, though. Can we do it now real quick?
Yeah, it won't take very long.
Anybody else, if you're going to, go ahead and grab a quick signature page. When you get the chance and complete that, would you state your name, title, and agency? Thank you. For the record.
Is this on? Yeah. Okay. There you go, Annie. My name is Shannon Vogel, representing Texas Medical Association. And I just wanted to briefly comment that before, Paula, when you asked about the connectivity project and marketing, that TMA did work with the local HIEs that are part of the connectivity project to disseminate material to our physicians about that, letting them know, because we think it's a really important project and a great opportunity. So I just wanted to extend that to THSA, that if there's something more that we can do on your behalf, we are absolutely happy to. And George, glad to work with you and your team on that. So, and also just thank you for your work, board. Y'all do great work, so thank you for that.
What is the connectivity project?
The IAPD 92 matching.
Oh, ours. Yes. I thought you were referring to something that was within TMA.
Okay. What the HIEs got funded for. Great. So we want to make sure our members know about that because, again, it's such a great opportunity. So if there's something more that we can do, please let us know.
And we did have a wonderful discussion about this at the HIT committee meeting, and it was
I'm
really
so
great.
Disappointed. May 1 is our annual meeting.
Yeah, that also occurred to me after we
I don't want to hurt the new
it. Yeah,
that's
so
okay,
unfortunately, I assume Ms. Vogel is probably not going to be here with us for the May 1 meeting.
I'll miss you.
It'll be recorded.
And likewise, I will not be in attendance probably. It's probably more important for me to be here instead of the HIT committee meeting. But that is, as we've discussed today, it's a good opportunity for collaboration. And we really enjoyed the discussion from the physician with the physicians and local HIEs were there as well about this project.
There.
So yeah. I thought that was very good. So thank you.
And I think the Collaboration Council, too. Great work. So
again. But we'll keep that going, just not on May 1.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment. All right. So members, at this point in time, the THSA, in accordance with the Texas Government Code, Section 551.074A1, needs to go into executive session to discuss personnel matters. We will now take a vote to enter into executive session, at which time the voting members of the board will stay here, and we will kindly ask the members of the public to briefly leave the room. Is there a motion to recess into executive session?
So moved.
And second. Okay, great. The motion has been made and seconded. In favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The board will recess into executive session at 11:38.
Motion.
Motion is made and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The ayes have it, and the board will end its executive session and reconvene into the open session at 12:18. Thank you. I would like to thank everyone for a really productive meeting today. Is there a motion to adjourn the meeting and the Board of Directors of the Texas Health Services Authority?
So moved.
Motion seconded. In favor say aye. Those opposed? And the motion passes, and this meeting is adjourned at now 12:19. Thank you. Thank you. Safe travels, everyone. Yeah, we can't.